So in session 7, the theme is emotional intelligence. Are we born with emotional intelligence, or is it acquired by training the mind? We live in a diverse society and need to be sensitive to the needs of others, even if their values and beliefs are not aligned with our own. How can we develop emotional intelligence and recognize emotions as they arise? How can we identify the cause, label them accordingly, and express them appropriately without harming oneself or others? How will mindfulness and kindness help in this respect? We have 3 speakers in this segment, and the first speaker is a monk who is an author of many books, including Life is Meditation, Meditation is Life. He has practiced meditation for over 42 years and founded the Dhamma Sukha Meditation Center and teaches a style of meditation called Tranquil Wisdom Insight Meditation. He leads meditation retreats worldwide and is the U.S. representative to the World Buddhist Summit. He's none other than Bhante Vilamarasam. Did I get it wrong? Vilamaramsi. Thank you. Vimalaramsi, the role of mindfulness in developing emotional intelligence. Please join me to welcome him on stage. Yes, sir. Please go ahead.
I have a couple questions before we get started, and I'd like to know what your answers would be. 1, what is craving? 2, that's a standard answer. 2, how do you recognize craving when it arises? Three, how do you let go of craving after you recognize that you have some? Well, it gets real interesting, doesn't it? Okay, I'm going to give you some definitions that you're not going to be real familiar with. Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. How do you recognize craving? By a tension and tightness in your head, in your mind. How do you let go of craving? By relaxing that tension and tightness in your head, in your mind. Now, some of you have been talking about this pain in your head, and you have all kinds of explanations that are marginal. The pain in your head is caused by that tension and tightness of craving. And when you relax that tension and tightness, craving goes away. What happens when you let go of craving? Your mind is very bright, your mind is very clear, and your mind is pure. Why is it pure? Because you have let go of craving. You don't have any thoughts in your mind at that time. Your mind is very alert. Then when you start practicing right effort, you relax, you bring up something wholesome. Now, what I like to tell people to do is that's the time to smile, because that helps your mind be light. And a thing with smiling that a lot of people don't really recognize is that when you smile all the time, it improves your mindfulness. Not just a little bit. Now, an interesting thing is that we've been talking about mindfulness for 2 days. Have you heard a real definition of mindfulness? Right. So there's all these definitions floating out here. The people that are talking about it, they know what they're talking about, but does anybody else? I'm going to give you a definition of mindfulness. Now, I am a meditation teacher, so I'm going to give it to you according to meditation. Mindfulness is remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. Now, with this definition, you are going to go deeper in your meditation than you ever thought possible. Because when you start observing how mind's attention moves away from your object of meditation, what happened first? What happened after that? What happened after that? When you start seeing how this process works, and you start using what I call the six R's. The six R's are recognize when your mind is distracted. Release the distraction. Now, this is a point of contention for a lot of people doing meditation because they say you're supposed to watch it till it goes away. But that's not what right effort says. Right effort says to let it go. Don't keep your attention on that distraction. Relax the tension caused by that distraction. Bring up something wholesome. Smile. Have a light mind. And bring that mind back to your object of meditation. Now, what have you done when you do this? You have let go of craving. And your mind is pure at that time. Now, I teach all over the world. I just got back from Kyrgyzstan by Russia. The people there are amazing. They understood the meditation very well after I gave them the instructions. There was 34 people on the retreat. About 32 of them had gotten into realms that you never hear about by ordinary meditators. Into the realm of nothingness, which is an arupa jhana, into the realm of neither perception or non-perception. How can that happen in a 10-day retreat? Well, let me explain it this way. There's more than one kind of jhana. And the people that are talking about the psychotherapy and all of these kind of things, they're talking about one-pointed concentration. The Buddha did not teach that. The Buddha taught aware jhanas, where when you're in a jhana, you still have vipassana, and you still have the four foundations of mindfulness while you are in the jhana. Why does it happen like this? Oh, let me tell you one more thing. I've started a new tradition. It's called Suttavada. Because whenever I give a Dhamma talk, I'm reading from the Sutta. So you know that it's not me that's talking about this. It is the Buddha himself. And the progress in the meditation is phenomenal. So it's real important to understand what these two different kinds of jhana are and how they differ. Now, your mind is on your object of meditation. Whether it's a breath or loving kindness, whatever it happens to be, doesn't matter. Your mind gets distracted. You let go of the distraction and immediately come back to your object of meditation. That is one-pointed concentration. When you're practicing one-pointed concentration, the force of the concentration suppresses the hindrances. Now, this is an important point. This takes you away from the Buddha's teaching. This is why a lot of people will say, oh, don't do jhana practice, it doesn't lead to nibbana. Well, actually it does. And there's many, many descriptions of that in the suttas. But it has to be the right kind of jhana practice. This one extra step of relaxing changes the entire meditation. And it's not a maybe. It really changes it a lot. Now, let's go to hindrances for a moment. Why do hindrances arise? Do any of you know? Because in the past you broke a precept. And you felt guilty. And you started identifying with it. You're saying, this is me. I did that. And that's a false belief in a personal self. So what Ajahn Brahm was talking about there being no self, is really true. It's a false belief when there is craving in your mind. I am that. So, when you're really doing a meditation and your mind gets distracted, you can notice that your mind is distracted for a little bit, and then you'll recognize, oh, I'm not on my object of meditation anymore. Then you let that distraction go. You don't keep your attention on the distraction. You don't have to figure out how to name that distraction. Just let it go. Relax the tightness caused by that distraction. Tightness here. Now, your brain has two parts to it. It has a membrane that goes around it. It's called the meninges. Every time you have a thought, every time you have a sensation or a feeling arise, the brain expands and it causes tension and tightness. So you have to be able to recognize that and let it be. Relax. Now you don't have any distracting thoughts. Your mind is pure. Your mind is alert. Your mind is very bright. And you bring that mind back to something wholesome. Now, I call this the 6 R's because I try to get people into the habit of smiling, okay, while you're sitting. Why? Because it uplifts your mind. And with an uplifted mind, your mind is very alert. So you can bring that mind back to your object of meditation, and you'll start staying on your object of meditation for longer. Now, for the last 25 years, I've been teaching the Brahma Viharas. And there's a lot of people that are practicing metta, and they try to practice the Brahma Viharas, but they don't really understand what the process is very well. The first 4 jhanas are loving kindness. Now, just in the last retreat I gave, by the 3rd day, almost everybody had gotten to the fourth jhana in 3 days. And this is kind of normal for me. I'm used to this kind of practice. Now, what's the difference between the way it's being taught from the commentaries as compared to what I'm teaching? The commentaries say you have to make 4 wishes and radiate that loving kindness to all beings in all 10 directions. And it turns into a mental exercise. But loving kindness is a feeling exercise. And when I start giving the instructions, I tell people, bring up a time when you were happy. When you have that happy feeling arise, it's a soft feeling in the center of your chest. Now, make a wish for your spiritual friend. Feel the wish. You know what it feels like to be peaceful and calm. You know what it feels like to be happy. Bring up that feeling. Put that feeling in your heart. And put your spiritual friend right in the middle of that feeling. And radiate that loving kindness to them. In a short period of time, you're going to be able to stay with your spiritual friend for longer and longer periods of time. When you get to the fourth jhana, you're able to stay with your spiritual friend 10 minutes, 15 minutes, something like that. And from there on, you go into the arupa jhanas, which is the rest of the Brahma Viharas. And this is taken from the Samyutta Nikaya.
Bhante, yes. We're going to have to keep the suspense at that next level of jhana. If that's okay.
I was just finishing.
Okay.
So, it happens naturally. Once you get to the fourth jhana, you don't really feel your body anymore. But you feel your head. And now you're in a mental realm, 100% mental realm. And as you go deeper into your meditation and you're able to stay with your loving kindness, it will change to a feeling of compassion. And I have a set of questions that I ask you about it so you can't fake it. Compassion is a definite feeling and it's different than what almost everybody tries to describe it as. But not only do you have this feeling of compassion, you start feeling an expansion happening in your head. And it just keeps going out and out and out. And this is called infinite space. As you go deeper, that feeling of compassion changes. And you feel joy. Now, they generally call it sympathetic joy, altruistic joy, but it's just joy.
Okay, Bhante, we're going to have to stop at joy.
Okay.
But we'll come back to what's after joy. I'm taking my orders from the boss. Sorry? There are 2 more speakers, so the boss is to... Okay, so the boss says continue. So,
pretty quick.
Bhante, if you could keep that within 2.5 minutes.
I'll try.
Thank you. 2.5 minutes.
Okay, you get a feeling of joy, But at one of the sense doors, you're going to notice a very fast flickering. Very fast. It can be at the eyes, the ears, one of the sense doors in the head. That was roughly 100,000 arising and passing away of ear consciousness. This flickering is your mind becomes so calm, you're going to start seeing individual consciousnesses arise and pass away. And you're going to see up close and personal how everything is changing. You're seeing individual consciousnesses very fast. And you see that it's a kind of unsatisfactory feeling. And you also see very, very clearly that this is impersonal. There's no controller over it. It happens by itself. So this particular realm is called infinite consciousness. With joy. As you go deeper, you get into the realm of nothingness. And nothingness is a real interesting state, but it also has very, very deep tranquility and equanimity. There's no excitement in your mind anymore. As you continue to sit longer, you start sitting for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, like that. And you'll sit for long periods of time without any disturbance in your mind. You'll get to a place that's like being asleep and being aware at the same time. And then that fades away and you just have peaceful, calm, no disturbance for long periods of time. Half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, without the slightest disturbance in mind. And this is called neither perception nor non-perception. Eventually, you'll get to a place where there's a cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. It happens for just a short period of time. When you come back, you feel immediate relief. You can see some little movements of mind's attention, which is the links of dependent origination. And you have such joy that it's unbelievable. You have attained Nibbana. That's the first step.
Thank you. And now moving from mindfulness to kindfulness, the art of being kind and mindful at the same time. Please welcome back Ajahn Brahm.
Okay, first of all, I profoundly disagree with you. Out of kindness, following the suttas. I also kind of disagree with other things which are said here. Because one of the things which I was trained in great universities like Cambridge was always to be confident enough to disagree. In other words, to ask the tough questions. And one of the tough questions, first of all, something which was missing throughout the whole of this Buddhism and neuroscience, is the fact that is the brain really necessary? Because there is lots of very suggestive empirical evidence of people who are aware, intelligent, loving, but who have no brain. And the first, I gave this to Angie earlier, I had to get it back again. This was something which was given to me in Science, 12th of December 1980, a long time ago, Professor John Lauber, who managed to find one of his students, a graduate student in mathematics at Sheffield University, who had a slightly misshaped skull, and when they gave him one of the first MRIs, found that there was only, Lauber recalls, we saw that instead of the normal 4.5 centimeter thickness of brain tissue between the ventricles and the cortical surface, there was just a thin layer of mantle measuring a millimeter or so. His cranium is filled with cerebral spinal fluid. No thalamus, no anything. And this was a person who had got first class honours in mathematics, who was pursuing his graduate degree. Replicable? Yes, because that CT scan at the time was done many, many times. When I saw one of my friend's disciples, a GP over in Sydney, we were just discussing this, and he said, yes, he's seen that done many, many, many times. He said this causes such angst, such disturbance to people, because it totally goes against their theories. They say it's filed away as an anomaly. I love anomalies, because they're the ones which we should really be investigating. Not just the idea that of confusing correlation with causality. Because correlation with causality is, we see so an emotion coming up somewhere and a part of a usual brain lighting up. That's called correlation. And you can map that, but it's not causality. Is it the case that anger or love causes that brain to light up? Or is it the brain causing the emotion? You know, which way is it? Or is it something else causing that to happen? And I love challenging the fact that we've talked about looking under the bonnet to see the engine, but that always begs the question, what is looking under the bonnet to be able to see that engine? And so this is where we get to what in physics we always used to describe as a ghost. Ghost in the machine. This sense of mind. Now mind, I really object to the fact, the assumption, challenge it. The assumption that the mind has something to do with the brain. And this is just one piece of evidence. That the mind is something different from the brain. And the reason, the relevance of this is because I thought I was supposed to be talking about is emotional intelligence trained? Do we grow with it? Are we born with it? And of course, with people like Mozart and other child prodigies, the obvious explanation, using the scientific principle of Occam's razor, any science people here knows the obvious answer is that they take those tendencies from their previous lives. And one of my passions, as well as teaching meditation and telling jokes, is also getting a bigger picture of, you know, what we are here, why we are here, and what is actually going on here. And for mental health, and to create Buddhism, understanding the brain, understanding the emotions, if we don't even question and investigate the idea that we've been here before, and at the end of this world, at the end of this life, it's not just bye-bye, you know, see you again. Oh, no, I won't see you again. It's, yes, we're going to come back again. And I am really sort of challenging science. So please, come on, face that evidence. In one of the earlier talks, the first yesterday, I was talking about that experiment, which my very good friend, the first Buddhist I ever met, Professor Bernard Carr, from the Queen Mary College, which I mentioned to give the credibility to this friend. He is a Buddhist. He's an investigator to psychic research, ghosts, paranormal phenomena, basically the mind, to find out. This is a guy with cred. You know, a very close student of the most famous physicist, scientist alive today. That's Professor Stephen Hawkins, that this fellow is very interested in taking the research, not from neuroscience, you know, about how emotions and the brain interact, but even the whole idea of a brain being so fundamentally the cause of our emotions. See if there's something else which is going on there. And of course that is investigating this thing which we say is far, far bigger than the brain, the mind. That also occurs, as many people see, when they have hypnotic regressions, where people claim to remember previous lives. That is much more easy, it seems, than going into deep meditation, recording your past life. And as anecdotes, you know, our current, well, one of the people I know, I better be careful not to sort of tell people's names, otherwise they do get questioned and challenged. So to protect him, a good friend, Australian, Caucasian, a naval officer, that's about as far as I can go. To say this is the last person you'd expect, you know, not a sort of an airy-fairy sort of person, but the last person you'd expect managed, you know, just by chance, he was checking out hypnotic regression for his brother, managed to get clear recollections of a previous life, didn't believe them at all, but, you know, decided out of curiosity to investigate, you know, whether those clear names and places, the name of the person he married, the place where they married, the place where they lived, the house which he built, the title deeds, his children's name, the place where he died, that all turned out to be 100% correct. Which really blew his mind. Literally. He realized, and he's got obviously no doubt, if that happens to you, you know, this comes up, and this is not sort of something which you could get from any other source of information, that comes up, that is very convincing evidence for you. You'll never be able to convince other people unless people are open to be able to accept that and understand that. It's one of the reasons, again, going back to that Bernard Carr's, Professor Bernard Carr's idea of the levitating flower pot, and people just cannot see it. The evidence is there, which is one of the reasons why the idea of bare awareness, I'm sorry, but I fundamentally disagree with that. You just can't see these things. Until just what the Bhante Vemurangsi was saying, the five hindrances which distort perception, which make you see what you want to see rather than what's really there, which make you block out what is too difficult for you to see. That is the purpose of the deep meditations. Without those deep meditations, without overcoming those five perversions of perception, or the five causes for not seeing what's really there, that is where we stop seeing the truth. We block out things like the nature of this thing which we call the mind. Now, once we actually just can actually understand and accept this mind is not the brain, but is something much more fundamental, that actually changes the ball game. One of the things which it changes, the fear of death. I love to challenge and see things in a different way, simply because that is how I was trained, not only by an Ajahn Chah, but also by great universities, which would always let you challenge. And we got something just like quantum physics, which I love because that was giving some experimental, fundamental truth on how we create our reality. Schrodinger's equation of quantum physics. Is there any physicist here? If they're not, please can we get some for the next global conference? They're well worth their money challenging us to make us go further. Schrodinger's theorem, which is usually accepted now, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, of just how we create the reality. Reality is not out there. It's not objective. We actually create it. And so I'm always asking and so challenging, how much of your research is actually what you expect to see. How much are you actually creating those lighted spots in that mind? He was actually proving, and very highly respected science, that there is no such thing as objective reality. We make it, we change it, we alter it, we pervert it. We make the reality according how we think it should be, how we expect it should be. And that really challenges stuff. Now, with that, it also goes to the nature of Buddhism. I only bring this up because this is supposed to be neuroscience, the science of the brain. I'm just changing it and not Buddhism, because that is totally straight down the line Buddhist teachings. You know, to see just the mind is the creator of all things, the forerunner, the first verse of the Dhammapada. And to see that, you know, this great teacher could actually manage to actually present this in such a way that you can find out for yourselves. We don't do this by believing what you're taught. We always challenge. We're open to that challenge. And there's a way to find out the truth. If the truth is not got by insight, as I mentioned yesterday, it is samadhi paccaya yata buddha yana dasana, from stillness. And samadhi, please don't call it concentration. Concentration is too forceful. And it's not the meaning of the word in Pali. There's many the great monks here. You can check it how that word is used, even translated in the Chinese Agamas, which is a great cross-reference to understanding just how the Pali and the Sanskrit Agamas actually come together and make great understandings. If anyone wants to research this, Ajahn Annalio and Sujato and my good friend Ajahn Bomali, who did some excellent research on the Authenticity Project, finding out what the Buddha actually really taught. And all traditions have added something. It's not that Theravada is innocent, we have added a lot. So has Mahayana, so has Vajrayana. So there is a means to get to the core teachings. And when you can find that, it really opens up what those suttas really are. I do agree with you, Venerable. The suttas are the core teachings of the Buddha. But first of all, we have to understand exactly what the Buddha said and push aside all the stuff which was added afterwards, which, please excuse me, was the Abhidhamma. That was clearly added after the time of the Buddha. I'm old enough now, enough disciples to be protected. There is no vipassana jhanas in the suttas. Gopakamogalana Sutra, as you know, the Buddha only recommended four types of meditation. First, second, third, fourth jhana. That's what it says there. It's great being Ajahn Brahm because I don't live in Canada. I don't live in US. I don't live in Burma. I don't live in Thailand or Sri Lanka. I can leave the country. I've got my safe house in Perth. So I can say these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for that challenge. I don't think you were expecting a boring... So if you wanted some Dhamma entertainment, here it goes. The third challenger coming up on stage today is going to supposedly speak on this topic. Don't bank on it. Compassion as a tool for gradual reduction of stress and emotional healing, which is Bhante, who's been a Buddhist monk for 36 years and is known for his peace efforts and humanitarian activities, which he has received many awards for. He's also the chairperson of the Spirit and the spiritual director of the Triple Gem Buddhist Society, the Center for Conscious Evolution in Princeton, and the founding director and spiritual advisor for the prison ministries in the U.S. So please join me to welcome Bhante Vimala.
Thank you. Two great venerables and two great presentations I'm in trouble. I have forgotten my whole speech. We have been speaking about compassion all our lives, and especially during these 2 days. We might have heard the word compassion hundreds of times. We look at it from scientific perspectives and Buddhist perspectives. I would like you to take a moment to reflect on your personal experience of compassion. Have you ever had a deep moment of compassion? Have you ever experienced a deep moment of compassion? How would you define it? How would you describe it? How would you explain that? When compassion rises from within, and have you ever had a moment where you were touched, when you were touched by a compassion of somebody, compassion of another person? How was it like? Do you remember? Some of you might not have a clue what compassion is. A personal experience. Try to reflect on your life without going into any definition of a book or remember somebody else's explanation. Once, when I was in Nairobi Buddhist Temple, a woman came to visit me, a distressed woman. She said she had a question for me. We sat down and she said she had questions about compassion. Her first question was, why does compassion hurt us so much? I asked her to explain. She was from the United States, and she had a mild depression. Her psychotherapist asked her to do some acts of compassion so that she can feel better and overcome depression. So she contacted this organization in Africa. She came to work in an AIDS orphanage, where babies were dying every day. She was telling me, I feel so much compassion for these children. Every day I experience so much pain. It hurts. These children are dying without medicine and proper care, and I feel totally helpless. So in our discussion, I was trying to explain to her, compassion is not a negative emotional reaction to the suffering of others, compassion flows from the awareness of the suffering of another person or oneself. Compassion can never hurt you. Compassion can cause no pain. Compassion never disturbs you. As the feelings of compassion rises within you, you experience a great comfort. And when you look at that person who is in front of me, who is suffering, who is pain, who is distressed, your presence, your words, your touch, your thoughts brings that person comfort. So, as I was discussing this, he was asking, so I have not been compassionate? And I asked, can you define compassion, or how do you understand compassion? She says, I thought compassion is the ability to experience pain of others who are suffering. That's what triggered these feelings in you. And I told her, first of all, I'm sure some of you might have some experiences when you might have felt the pain of others. Anybody have felt the pain of another person? And in my discussion, I explained to her, it's impossible for us to feel the pain of another person. Zero. Not possible. When you say that you feel the pain of the others or these children, what you're saying is that I feel my own pain. As you negatively react, as you get disturbed by what you see, your mind gets stirred up, the anxiety rises, and the intensity of your pain, duration of your pain, all depends on the intensity of your pain, depends on the intensity of the anxiety that rises within you, or intensity of negativity that rises within you. So actually, when you are disturbed by the emotional turmoil or negative reactions to what you see, you have no clue what other person is going through. You are disconnected because you get lost in your own pain, which it rises from. So when people get lost in their own pain and feel hurt, feel suffering, they think, I feel your pain. If you really want to feel the pain of somebody, it's important that you prevent yourself from getting lost in an emotion, a negative emotional chaos. You prevent yourself getting into sad, hopeless, helpless state. In that moment, your mind is clear, you are attentive, you are fully present, and suddenly a warmth flows through you and you feel. You understand. And then, she says, can you tell me an example? When I was 13 years old, I came to the temple. I was bitten by a dog. The flesh was torn off my thighs. As my brother brought me home, I lied on a bed and my mom was there. I was scared that my father might be there because he might have punished me for getting in trouble. So I lied down and I was bleeding, and my mother came, and the way she attended me, she was calm, she was present, she was very kind. Her warmth in that moment, I felt as though an angel looking down at me. I felt a compassion of her, or kindness. So this experience I still carry with me. Any time when I am in pain, I visualize her face. It is a healing experience. So your ability to be fully present, when you are fully present and fully conscious, all four divine virtues of human heart, the loving kindness, compassion, as is the joy and equanimity. The moment the mind become alert and fully present, the warmth that flows from you is truly a nurturing experience. So, I think I have just a few more minutes left. So, how can we bring compassion into our daily life? When you have an argument with somebody at home, if you can step back and become self-aware, calm yourself down, slow your mind, and pay attention to the harsh words or aggressive behavior of that person, prevent yourself reacting blindly or getting lost in a blind reaction. In that moment, if compassion rises within you, suddenly you have no desire to be revengeful, because you see that person is trying to hurt you verbally. A desire to hurt others comes from their own pain. So you begin to sense the person's, the pain that person is going through as that person behave abusively or speak abusive words. This awareness of the suffering of the mean person, it is painful to be mean, it is painful to be angry, it hurts to hate others, it's painful to be jealous. So when you notice, when the compassion rises, you notice the suffering, the pain of the person who is trying to hurt you, or where their behavior arises from, and suddenly you have no desire to hit back, or you have no desire to speak abusive words or angry words toward that person. And also what is interesting is, as you come to that place of compassion, I would say, if an emotion disturbed state of mind, compassion is not an emotion. In that moment, the other person, the aggressor, experience healing. So anyway, my time is up, and thank you, and wish you well. May you be very happy.
Thank you very much, Venerable Vimala. So now we will open the floor to the floor for questions, and don't come running down. But we're certainly excited to have you ask questions, pose challenges, whatever you wish, in order to clarify what may be confusing or seeking more information. So can we have the first question coming from that gentleman up there?
Hello. My name is Cyril Vidatunga. I'm an engineer background. My question is for Bhante Ajahn Brahm. Have you ever heard of people with no gray matter at all in the brain, with a stem only?
With a stem on it, there was a recent case of a postal worker over in France who seemed to, you know, not sure if he had a stem, what he had. I can give you the article afterwards, yes. But that's actually all this other case of this young man in Sheffield University. I don't think he had a stem. But you can have a look at afterwards and you can check it out for me.
So my second question is, in that case, if you're always referring to the brain and making a mental connection, is there any value in connecting to the brain and mental health?
Yeah, obviously, if you have a brain, then make use of it.
If you don't have?
You don't have? You don't need it.
Okay. I'll settle for the second one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, do we have a question by the lady behind the gentleman?
Yes, I do.
Please go ahead.
My question is for Ajahn Brahm. So I'm a trauma survivor, and a lot of what you've taught here this weekend is things that I've incorporated in my healing process, and I've come an extremely long way. My difficulty is, you were speaking about it on Friday, about you're only renting your body, it's not yours. So I experience a lot of chronic pain, and I get this in theory. I have a difficult time putting it into practice. So when I'm experiencing an extreme amount of pain, it's hard not attaching to the pain, and I'm wondering if there's anything. So, for example, when I try meditation or mindfulness during these times of extreme pain, I'm one of these people that it tends to agitate more, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you can suggest.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just was opening it up here. It's this was something which I incorporated with the author's permission in the first book, which I wrote. It's the Truckload of Dung in the United States. I'll read it out for you. It's too much to hope for, is the title. It's too much to hope for a life without pain. It's wrong to expect a life without pain. For pain is our body's defense. No matter how much we dislike it, and nobody likes pain, pain is important, and for pain we should be grateful. How else would we know to move our hand from the fire, our finger from the blade, our foot from the thorn? So pain is important, and for pain we should be grateful. Yet, there is a type of pain that serves no purpose. That's chronic pain. It's that elite band of pain that's not for defense. It's an attacking force, an attacker from within, a destroyer of personal happiness, an aggressive assailant on personal ability, a ceaseless invader of personal space, personal peace, and a continuous harassment to life. Chronic pain is the hardest hurdle for the mind to jump. Sometimes it is almost impossible to jump. Yet, we must keep trying and trying and trying, because if we don't, it will destroy. And from this battle will come some good, the satisfaction of overcoming pain, the achievement of happiness and peace, of life in spite of it. This is quite an achievement very special, very personal, a feeling of strength, of inner strength, which has to be experienced to be understood. So we all have to accept pain, even sometimes destructive pain, for it is part of the scheme of things, and the mind can manage it, and the mind will become stronger for the practice. It was written by Jonathan Wilson Fuller, aged 9 years of age. I'll present this to you, please.
Would you like to come down and take that poem? Thank you.
It can be done.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. So could we have... Next question from...
Priya Lanindi, thank you for 3 wonderful days. It's been amazing. Learned a lot, but I have a very confusing situation right now. As a retired business executive and now a volunteer career coach and mentor, I'm faced with a dilemma. Right throughout my career, I've been told and I have been telling people, to be successful in this corporate world today, you have to be a survival of the fittest. So, to be a survival of the fittest, you have to be strategic, you have to be intelligent, you have to be honest, you have to be ethical. But at the same time, you have to be way above everybody else. Now, having listened to you for all 3 days, I'm now wondering whether I should say that phrase to anybody I'm talking tomorrow morning, because I'll be misleading them, because to me, mindfulness, connections, kindliness, gentleness, compassion are very, very important. So I'm in conflict right now as to how we can handle conflict in these 2 particular ways of communicating. So if you could please help me.
Who would you like this question to be answered?
All by? 3.
All 3 are. We don't have that much time, so could you
Ajahn
just...
Ajahn Brahm, would you please address?
Okay, Ajahn Brahm, please.
Well, I've already done 3.
Oh, well, he's done 3. So would one of you like to respond?
An interesting thing that's... really useful is one to develop a definition of compassion that doesn't have pain in it. And what I used to go to hospitals very often, and before I would walk in the room, I would tell myself, their pain is theirs. I can't take their pain away. But I can love them. As soon as I started walking in the room, I would start radiating loving kindness to that person. They might be moaning and in extreme pain. In a matter of a minute or less, all of a sudden their pain becomes less. And before long, I'm talking to them in a regular way. And I try to get them to laugh, because that helps to overcome the extreme pain. So practicing loving kindness in the one of the suttas that I can't remember the name of right now, the Buddha talked about sending loving and kind thoughts to any person that you're talking to. And then when you walk away from them, send loving and kind thoughts to all beings in all directions. keeping loving kindness in your mind all the time helps your mind to have a sense of balance so that you won't get knocked off balance so easily. You're still going to have ups and downs.
That's right.
But you'll have more equanimity in your mind so that they're not so radical ups and downs.
Thank you. Thank you, Venerable Himala Ramji.
There is suffering all around us, and we can't escape. It is important to... We can't eliminate suffering around us. That's why it's important for us to be prepared. I have gone to some of the worst places during disaster times, and it's so important for me to prepare myself and remind myself where I'm going to. So if you can take few minutes in the morning when you get up, even before you get off the bed, if you can relax your body and take few mindful breaths and remind yourself few positive, you know, affirmations. For example, I'm going out and I'm going to face these challenges today. Today, I will face all the challenges calmly, patiently, with self-confidence, or calmly, patiently, or with positive enthusiasm. If you keep repeating this in your mind a few times before you get off the bed, you prepare yourself. As you know, your personality creates your personal reality. All your thoughts and feelings build your personality. So if you introduce positive, realistic, conscious thoughts and dwell in the meanings of those thoughts in the beginning of the day, before you start the day, you may handle them more mindfully and you may not be affected by what you see, feel and hear, and you will be able to be present and you will be able to radiate healing through a sense of compassion.
I have a lot of homework to do, I'm sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Venerable Vimala. Do we have another question from there?
My name is Ron from Ohio, and I'd like to begin with an answer. You asked if there's a physicist. I'm a physicist in the healthcare setting. I greatly appreciate you and your teachings. I relate to the entire world from its physical properties and view the world as a laboratory to establish what we know about our surroundings. And looking at it from that perspective, I see the world and the reality as a fallacy. Now, for a question, first a statement. I've heard a lot about Buddhism, neuroscience, healthcare. However, I haven't, the science that I apply is a health science dealing with medical physics and the instrumentation. And the way I see healthcare being practiced is you have the healthcare practitioners that are artists. They're practicing art. They get to Carnegie Hall by practice, practice, practice. I'm a physicist. I deal with the science, the technology, the imaging. And the way I see medicine is you have the art and the science, and then you have the fusion that comes together. And from what I understand of Buddhism, it's really a science of evolution, understanding our environment, the mind, the interactions of the mind, and an evolution of how the mind has evolved over time. And what I have not heard at this conference is where we're going. In healthcare, the two biggest terms that I wrestle with, augmented reality and machine learning. And that's driving healthcare, and it hasn't even been talked about in this conference. So if we want to look at the direction of where we're going, we have to look to the future. And what does Buddhism have to say about the evolution of where we're at today and where the future of medicine is going? Oh, I'm sorry, Ajahn Brahm. You're the physicist. I relate to you the best.
Okay, do you want the small picture or the big picture?
The Big Bang.
Okay, the Big Bang. There was life before the Big Bang, first of all. I was very pleased when I looked at that bio, the theory of everything, of Stephen Hawking. I looked at that because my best mate was in there. And also I really took on board where Stephen Hawking mentioned that he knows now a universe without boundaries. Now, to know what that means, I postulated that many years ago, 500, 600 years ago, most people thought this planet Earth was flat, that if you went far enough, you'd fall off the edge. And everyone, reasonable, logical inference, they really thought that. And of course, soon people realized that no, that this Earth is round. It's got limited space, limited area with no boundaries. And of course, I also remember as a young man contemplating, visualizing this universe. And is there an edge to this universe? Now, if you go far enough at warp speed 10, you know, in Star Trek, you know, that was a long time ago. But, you know, would you get to some boundary? What would that boundary look like? And of course now, you know, I know that this universe has got a limited space. It's got limited volume without any boundaries. First of all, you can't get your head around that. It doesn't make any sense until you know that space is curved, curves around on itself. People don't realize that Toronto is the center of the universe. That if you go in any direction from here, you come right back again. And it'll take a bit of a while, you'll be dead by then. This place will not probably be here, but, you know, this is the spherical nature or the curved nature of space. And you just go that next step. Why are so many people flat timers? We believe that time has an edge. If you go back far enough, you come to the beginning of time. And then you have all the problems with how did that begin? And then you start getting God ideas, creator ideas, which I could never get my head around. If you go far enough, you get to the end of time, the Armageddon. And that, again, never made any sense to me. But the answer is that you're flat timers. Just like flat earthers. I see that in the, I don't know when, but people will come to the understanding that even time is curved. No beginning, no end, but limited. There was life before the Big Bang. There will be life afterwards. So we go on and on and on, round and round and round. We never get to a perfect world. If this world was perfect, we'd have nothing to learn, nowhere to grow. So don't try and find a utopia or a perfect world. World peace is a myth, an illusion. It will never happen, I'm sorry. But if there wasn't wars, there would not be any possibility for reconciliation, compassion, and learning. We're like a school. Every time you get grade ones, go through to grade 12s, and then they're out, and we always feel that, you know, no one learns anything until we realize that people go through this system of samsara, and we keep learning as we go. And those people who graduate, the enlightened beings, they're out of here. But the world keeps going on. It's the school, eternal, we pass through. Anyway, interesting.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. And,
and I can see it says time's up. No, time is eternal.
Not according to the organizer who has advised me to stay with the schedule. So we are going to be adjourning for a tea break, but do come back for the final session because we're going to be addressing enlightenment in this digital age, Buddhism in a secular age, as well as the aspects of gender equality and sexual identity. So see you at 3:20. 25 back in this auditorium. And thank you to the speakers. Could you give them a round of applause before you leave? Thank you.